Welcome, friends, and welcome to this conversation with Joseph Goldstein, one of the great Buddhist teachers of our time. In this conversation, Joseph transmits his wisdom, selflessness, and joy, and the amazing truth that enlightenment is ultimately inevitable for all sentient beings, including me and you. Welcome to Deep Transformation, Self, Society, Spirit. Life-enhancing, paradigm-rattling conversations with cutting-edge thinkers, contemplatives, and activists with Dr. Roger Walsh and John Dupuy. Join us in the evolutionary fast lane as we take a deep dive into transformational practice, peak experience, profound understanding, powerful contribution.
I'm Roger Walsh, and our co-host is John Dupuy, author of the text Integral Recovery. And our guest today is someone who's transformed my life and the life of many, many, many thousands of people. He's Joseph Goldstein, one of the world's best-known Buddhist meditation teachers. And Joseph has been practicing deeply for several decades now, about five of them. Joseph, like a number of other meditation teachers, was a member of the Peace Corps. And in the Peace Corps, he was introduced to Buddhism and took up the practices, then spent about 7 years, better part of a decade, doing full-time practice in India. So very deep practice. When he came back here, he started teaching, co-founded the Insight Meditation Society, one of the best-known Vipassana meditation centers in the country, if not now the world. I have spent over a year of my life tiptoeing around its halls under Joseph's guidance, and they were deeply transformative times, which I'm very grateful. Joseph is also known for his books. The initial one was The Experience of Insight, and when I was in Asia in various practice centers, it was interesting to me to find Asian monks carrying Joseph's book. And it's sort of like the practice or the Dharma was going from, had gone from east to west, but now is going from west to east, thanks to Joseph. He's also written a number of other books, all of which are remarkable for their rare combination of real depth and clarity. There's a real lucidity to Joseph's writing, which is beautiful. And as you'll see, to his mind, they're linked, as you can imagine. He's written, for example, Seeking the Heart of Wisdom with Jack Kornfield. Also, Mindfulness, A Practical Guide to Awakening, and the book One Dharma, which looks for the common core of ideas and practice across different Buddhist traditions. And they're just wonderful books. I highly recommend them if you're interested in these central practices at the heart of Buddhism. And Joseph is interesting in that he continues to practice. He puts aside maybe 3 months as it each year for a long retreat. And it's interesting. Not all teachers continue to practice so deeply, which is what might be an interesting topic for us to discuss. But anyway, Joseph, you have touched me in my life so deeply. I'm so happy to have this chance of doing a dialogue with you and to dive into the many topics of shared interest. And there are so many places we can begin, but maybe let's start with you've done your each year 3 month retreat. You're continuing to practice and teach. So what's on the edge for you these days?
Well, it's always the same edge, really. And the edge is not clinging and then seeing what I am clinging to. And that becomes the edge, you know, in terms of, yeah, really furthering that freedom of the mind that comes from letting go. And, you know, as you know very well, some of our attachments are very obvious to us, and we work with them in the various ways we do. But a lot of the attachments and clinging are really much more subtle, you know, and they start to reveal themselves, at least for myself, most clearly in deep retreat practice. So that's for me, it's just such a great joy to take that retreat time every year. It's like the highlight of the year for me.
And you're pointing to one of the features of the progress of practice, that increase in subtlety. that one looks at deeper and deeper and more subtle and discerning ways, and thereby is able to recognize that the things which impede our well-being and our awakening and our happiness, and the very, very seeing into those tends to release them. So, and it's interesting you say that it's the same edge. How would you conceive that edge? Is it a process of increasing subtlety? Do you see it like a spiral coming back to the same place? How do you see that?
You know, there are so many different examples, which I can share a couple with you. And I'm not totally sure that there's a pattern to kind of the increased subtlety. You know, as you know very well, having done yourself a lot of long retreats, we never quite know what's going to come up.
That's for sure.
And, you know, we may think, everything's going along so smoothly, we're cruising along, and then all of a sudden, you know, something comes up. I could say one of the interesting edges, perhaps, is even after all these years, a refinement of what mindfulness means. You know, and we can be going along and thinking we're being quite mindful of what's arising. And then at a certain point, something arises that challenges that understanding. So I'll give you a few examples.
Yeah.
So this was one time when I was practicing in Burma with my teacher, Saito Pandita. And I'd been there for a couple of months. Things were going seemingly pretty well. You know, my body was quite open and energy flow and all that. But there was one kind of block in my energetic block, you know, that even though most of the body felt really relaxed and open, there was this one spot. So I go in to report to Sayadaw and I describe my experience and I say, you know, but there's this one block that really seems stuck. And he got on my case for calling it a block. Because even in that interpretation, aversion is embedded.
Okay.
No good, want to get rid of it. And so I thought I was being mindful, you know, as I'm experiencing it and missing kind of that subtle level of aversion because of the concept I was laying on. You know, a block. Really, it was just different sensations, whether it was tightness or pressure or whatever it was. And it's just very interesting how our concepts about things often determine or condition our attitude about them. You know, so if we call it a block, there's some kind of either resistance to it or wanting to get rid of it. If we talk about it or understand it, changing sensations of pressure, that would be a more genuine mindfulness. So just this, I mean, this is such a simple thing, but I hadn't recognized it until Sayadaw pointed it out to me.
Well, Joseph, as probably somebody, not probably, but more of a Christian orientation with massive appropriation from other traditions. I mean, if that's a bad thing, I'm a bad boy because I've certainly influenced by practicing in the time that we grew up in our generations. We had so much richness there. But I wanted to, you know, and I would say, well, anyway, it's all God at some point, you know, whether resistance or not, whatever arises, there it is. But how would you characterize, you've been doing this for many, many years. And I imagine in the beginning, when you just had the realization, this is my path, like, oh my God, or oh my Buddha, whatever Buddhas say, you know, this is it. And now you've been in that relationship for many decades, or, you know, we don't have that many decades, but a number of decades. How would you characterize from that first kind of falling in love and honeymoon period to mature practitioner, teacher that you are today? Have you noticed a change in the quality of your practice and what that feels like?
Yeah, so I have a new favorite definition of enlightenment, which is lightening up. And in a way, even though I say it somewhat humorously, it does characterize, in my experience, the trajectory of the path, a subjective experience of it. And in the beginning, So another example, when I first began practice with my first teacher, Anagarika Munindra, I was really quite new to the practice and, of course, was seeing all kinds of unwholesome things arise in my mind. So I'd go running to Munindra, basically saying, not in these exact words, but this was the message, "Oh, I'm such a terrible person. Look what's happening in my mind." And of course, he would just smile and, you know, say, "Just continue." But there was that kind of relationship, that kind of reactivity to what was arising. Whereas over all these years, there has been a lightening up. And so now, as different things arise, there's much more the quality of interest and investigation and understanding. So it's a much lighter, more spacious, more interesting way of practice. There's a phrase that I use now in teaching a lot, coming out of my own experience. The phrase I use is, "Don't waste your suffering," meaning, you know, very often people either are just drowning in it, whatever kind of the suffering happens to be, or blaming others for suffering or blaming circumstances, instead of really using the suffering that we're experiencing to investigate in our own minds, well, what's the cause of it? Because the suffering is within our own minds. It's always how we're relating to certain experiences. It's not about the experience itself. But that takes some spaciousness and practice to begin to relate to our own suffering with that kind of interest, rather than just being totally caught up in it. So that's all part of the lightening up, you know.
And I want to there's so much in what you've said, Joseph. I want to emphasize some of it. One is this lightening up, and the second point is that the experience we have of something so much depends on our relationship to it. And that's key, particularly suffering, as you pointed out. And it also seems like that relates back to your earlier point of the very way we label our experience, even in quite subtle ways, has a profound impact. And I guess actually it's interesting, I hadn't thought of this before, but what Sayadaw was showing you was the trap of labeling an experience in any way which implied a negative valence to it, and suggesting you in your own insight saw, oh, there's another way of seeing this which is more fruitful and beneficial. Yeah. And I hadn't seen this before, but, you know, that's the heart of what in contemporary psychology is called the technique of reframing.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at an experience which is interpreted initially as problematic or an indication of something wrong with myself, and seeing it another way, as you just did with the block, or as with so many people do with, you know, I've experienced so many bad things, I must be a bad person, or you can reframe it, oh, you're really a survivor. You've held in there and come through these very painful experiences. So very interesting to see these connections.
I'd like to reframe one aspect of what you said.
Oh, you're going to one-up me.
if I may.
I don't know. I'll have to think about this. Okay.
Well, I think we'll be in agreement with this, because just as you were speaking, you know, and I was thinking, well, the ultimate reframe, perhaps from a Buddhist perspective, almost always for most people, and even for deep practitioners, very often in one way or another, the frame is the I. You know, mm-hmm. I'm so bad, or I'm so good, or my pain, or my suffering, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Whatever the experience is, the kind of meta frame, you know, mm-hmm. it's mine. I, me, and mine. And so reframing experience in a way that frees us from that, that's really a very liberating reframe.
So instead of mine, what is the alternative?
Well, so I'll give you an example of one way I've been teaching the walking meditation. I could give you a million examples, but this is what's coming to mind in the moment. So one of the things I noticed, first in my own experience and then in working with people, then just doing the walking meditation in whatever way one does it. You know, it might be kind of the very slow zombie walk, or it could be a more relaxed walk. Even when we're experienced enough to be somewhat connected to the sensations, you know, of the movement and the touch, it's so easy to have a very subtle and usually unnoticed overlay of concept of foot and leg. So even as we're connected with the actual sensations, but it's almost like it's a background frame of what's happening. You know, and very often people will report, oh, I feel my foot. But actually, we never feel the foot. There's no sensation called foot. But that's the immediate kind of conventional overlay. Very easy to go from foot to my foot. That's like a really easy segue. Well, my leg. So what I've been doing, I was suggesting to people, and this came through my own experimentation, you know, and it's one of the reasons I love being on retreat, because, you know, you asked about the forward edge. In a way, the forward edge has more to do with the attitude of exploration rather than any particular thing. Because sometimes things come up that I wouldn't even have thought about exploring, but it just happens in the course of the retreat. Okay, so I was just doing walking and I noticed this overlay, subtle. It's probably a psychological term for it, which I don't know. But I started then reframing it and actually using the noting of the elements. So in the walking, I would just, in moving, I would be noting air or air element and touching the ground, earth or earth element. And so I was walking, kind of dropping into the feeling of the body, feeling the sensations of the movement and the touch, but framing it as air element, earth element. And it was amazing to me. Just, it's so incredibly simple. But it was amazing to me how that dropped the mind into a rather vivid experience of the selflessness of it, because there's much less likelihood of saying my air element or my earth element, whereas my leg and my foot is almost automatic. You know, and so just the simple reframing in that way opens, or has the potential to open us to quite a immediate and vivid experience, even if it's just a taste of it, selflessness, the impersonality of all the elements of the body.
And that certainly is what, if we look across traditions, that emphasis on selflessness is clearly one of Buddhism's main central teachings. And, and again, there's a lot in what you said, Joseph. So just to maybe name it as a way of emphasizing, you're pointing out that in our usual experience or a conscious level of experience, there are usually layers of conceptualization between overlaid on top of direct sensations. And we relate to the concepts more than the direct experience. That's what's so incredibly, I mean, this can get sound very airy-fairy in a way, but it's really important because once you see that our lives are lived in relationship to what we overlay on our experience, and that the possibility of undercutting that, of going to the direct experience, is itself healing and transformative, that opens a lot.
Yeah, and just to add to that, or to embellish it a bit, what you're saying, it really points to such a significant point of deepening the practice when we drop from the conceptual level, to the level of direct experience. And the reason, or one of the reasons it's so important, that shift, is that the concepts we use to describe an experience doesn't change. Leg today, leg tomorrow, leg yesterday. And so as long as we're on the level of concept, it reinforces some sense, even of relative permanence, right? That mm-hmm. same thing, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And yet when we're on the level of direct experience, we could say the energetics of it, we see there's nothing lasting at all. Everything is in constant change, yeah. microscopic level, moment after moment. And as you know very well, the experience, in some way, I see the one of the progressions of the path as being a refinement of the perception of change.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a little anecdote. Somebody once asked Suzuki Roshi, this guy said, you know, I've been listening to your talks for years and I still don't understand it. Can you please express Buddhism in a nutshell? And Suzuki thought for a moment and he said, everything changes. And that I so appreciate it, because even though everyone knows that on an intellectual, conceptual level, that's not an esoteric truth, that everything changes. But we're not living it, you know, and we're not often directly perceiving it. And of course, it's the one doorway or one support for non-clinging is through seeing that everything is changing. Yeah, and the more we see it on a more and more refined level, we see that if we're clinging to that which changes,
we're in trouble.
And somebody came in, a meditator came in once to an interview having this insight, and they said, holding on to that which is impermanent is like rope burn. You know, if you're holding on tightly to a rope and it's being pulled through your hand, the tighter you hold on, the more you suffer. You know, and we see that. You know, we see that on so many different levels.
Joseph, we're getting ready for this, and you sent us a 10.5 page paper that you've written. And I was like, 10.5 pages, no problem. And I was just, it took me a long time to feel so good after having completed it. I mean, I really got worked out intellectually, spiritually, emotionally. It was really good for me. I want to thank you for that. And I want to bring out a couple of things that you talked about in that paper. And one of the things is that, you know, we can have experiences of no self or emptiness. And boom, when you were on the beach in Oaxaca and you took the mushrooms, you know, in 1968, you know, this amazing thing. And it's always an amazing thing, but it becomes more of a memory instead of something that transforms you at the deepest levels. And then there's experiences that may be just the same, but they have a transformative aspect to them, that everything is different. It's never the same. And that's very mysterious. And I think it's very real too. But could you comment on that?
Yeah, well, I would like to hone in on one aspect of what you said, where you mentioned it may be the same experience, but in the one hand, it's transformative and another, it's not particularly. I would question whether it's actually the same experience, because as you know so well, there's such an incredible range of subtle and unusual experiences of consciousness, you know, and some very refined states. And I think it's easy to misinterpret what we're experiencing. Here's where, you know, having the guidance of a good teacher can be really helpful, you know, who has a lot of experience with at least some range of these very subtle states. So as I mentioned in that paper, for me, and I think in the Theravada tradition, at least, you know, Buddhism, I've been so connected to, the bottom line for assessing the transformative value of these different experiences is whether or not the defilements have been uprooted or not. because that's the salient mark of, at least in this tradition, of the different stages of awakening or enlightenment. So if people have a very, to use a Buddhist term, far out experience, it may well be, a moment of genuine realization, but it may not be. It may be just another quite powerful experience. And the measure of it is, has the defilement been uprooted or not?
Joseph, can that be a gradual thing? In other words, you have experience and you get about a 30% relief, from your defilements and these clingings and all this stuff. And then with more practice, you have more experiences, but gradually it begins to recede.
Yes.
Until you're where, where you wanted to be when you started.
Well, I think that this points to the age-old Buddhist controversy of gradual and sudden awakening.
Sorry for stirring that pot.
Yeah. No, because I think it's a really important point, because in my mind, there was always a false dichotomy that it's always gradual until it's sudden. And so in reference to your question, there, just through our practice, there is a diminishment. The stronger the mindfulness gets and the more insight we have, there's definitely a diminishment of the power of the defilements. And that moment, we could call it sudden awakening, is that moment when it's not only a diminishment of it, but an actual uprooting of it, so that it doesn't arise again. But those two are not disconnected. It's mostly, it's because there has been the gradual diminution of them.
When it finally happens, it's sudden.
Yeah, exactly. But I just want to add one more thing, because this is something that I also think is really important and sometimes not understood that well. We're going back to the whole notion of how we frame things. So there was, I think he was 11th century, Korean Zen master, Shinul. There's a wonderful book of his teachings, and the book is called Tracing Back the Radiance. So his frame for the whole path, which I really loved, he called it sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. So he was highlighting the potential, even slightly different from what I was just talking about, but the potential for a sudden awakening. And again, whether that comes after a long period of practice or sometimes, there are some people, for whatever background they have just have a sudden awakening. But what Shinul is saying is that even when there is that moment of sudden awakening, it needs a gradual cultivation, because especially in the first moments of awakening, or we could say the first stages of enlightenment, there are still many defilements left. And he uses a phrase, this will be a bit of a paraphrase, but he says something like, the hindrances are formidable. And so it's a mistake to think that one moment of realization will eradicate or uproot all of them. So therefore, even after that first moment, it takes a gradual cultivation to further weaken and uproot the rest. But he then goes on to say something which is equally important. But having had that moment of realization, then in the practice of gradual cultivation, we're relating to it completely differently. So our practice post moment of awakening really takes on a different flavor than the practice before. But it still requires the further cultivation. And I just love that, because it just brings, to me, it just brings it all together.
Very helpful. Yes.
Yeah, very beautiful. Yes.
As we all know, unfortunately, a lot of teachers sometimes get into trouble. One of the reasons I think that can happen is there may be actually be moments of genuine realization, but then if there's the assumption, oh, well, I'm all done now, and everything I do is coming from this realization, so that all kinds of unwholesome actions can manifest. And so that's why I love the sudden awakening, gradual cultivation as being essential.
Yeah. Joseph, I keep wanting to start everything I say, but there's so much in what you've said, but there was a lot in what you just said. So I want to I want to bring out some of them and continue where you're going. First off, I just want to note, I love the, and one of your gifts is the precision of your looking and conceptual and thinking about these. And one of the traps that's been intimated in a lot of what you said is that when we're not sufficiently precise in the way we think or in our looking, that's a major root of suffering. So you just pointed to not just an integration of gradual practice, sudden awakening. You added in the gradual process of integration afterwards. So there was the cultivation and insight or realization or even awakening. And then a necessary process, which often seems to get skipped over. There has to be an integrative process. And one of the things that really stuck in my mind was when I was actually meditating with you, and I just limit myself to a page or two of reading each day. It was a Zen story, and someone had a Zen practitioner had an awakening, and the teacher said, "You must not teach for 2 years." Okay. And yes, that makes a lot of sense, because the deeper the experience, in some ways, the more time should be allowed for a real integration. We tend to have this almost magical presupposition about deep experiences, whether they're in practice or now contemporaneously with psychedelics, that the experience will immediately do it all. And then we get a free ride afterwards. You're pointing to something much deeper and richer. That there needs to be an active working with after a deep insight.
Yeah, so this seems to be our pattern, Roger. So I'd like to just embellish a little bit more.
please do. we have a routine.
Yeah. So I agree totally with what you said, but I think it's actually more than just an integration of that experience. Because until we're fully enlightened, that experience, even if it's touching the ultimate truth, is not the full experience of it. And so even afterwards, it has been transformative. We've touched bottom, or we touched zero, or we touched emptiness, you know, whatever word we want to use. But the experience we had, how to say this? That there's further things to understand. So it's not just integrating that experience, but it's staying and continuing to stay at the forward edge of our practice. So it actually deepens further. And this is kind of a frame which I read once for why, at least in Theravada, but every tradition has its own map, you know, but in the Theravada map, they talk about four stages of enlightenment. And I came across just this reference to the reason why enlightenment happens in four stages. And it said because for most people, you know, there are exceptions, extraordinarily, you know, gifted people spiritually, but for most people, because we're not able to open to the magnitude of suffering, to the magnitude of dukkha, right, which is the first noble truth. So in that first path, first stage, we open to a significant extent, and this is really interesting. So we've uprooted at that point the view of self. We no longer have the belief in self because we've gone beyond it, you know, in that moment. But interestingly enough, there's still desire in the mind. There's still aversion in the mind. There's still restlessness in the mind, still conceit in the mind. They're seen differently. They're seen as being impersonal, but those patterns are still there. So why is desire still there? Because we have not appreciated to the full extent the magnitude of dukkha, the first noble truth. And so our practice is a continual deepening. Not only of that, you know, it's a deepening of many other things as well. So just a little personal anecdote. when I first went to India and studying with Munindra, he loved talking about the Buddhist cosmology you know, and the devas and the different realms of existence and all of that. I loved it. You know, a lot of the Westerners, they're very skeptical, you know, but I resonated with all of that. And then he described one path to full awakening where he said, there's one path where you just go from the human realm to the lower heaven realms, to the next higher heaven realms, all the way up the scale, up to the Brahma realm, you know, all of these, you know, glorious realms of existence. And then full enlightenment. And being the greedy type personality that I am, I thought, oh, I like that path. You know, it's just going from one kind of happiness to another higher, and then final liberation. So, that, you know, that's been in my mind all these years. Then I start studying with Sayadaw Pandita, you know. And when I first met him, I hadn't known him before. And I don't know how it came up, but he asked me, you know, what my aspiration is in practice. So I told him, you know, well, this sounds like a good way. He looked at me as if I had just said the stupidest thing in the world. It's like from his frame, because he understood the First Noble Truth in a much deeper way than I had yet, to him, all of those realms still fall within the framework of the First Noble Truth. Right? So that's just what I mean of, it's not only integrating, you know, that first moment of awakening, but it's actually a continued deepening of our insights.
Going back to the paper and your summation, and I'm sure I'm paraphrasing this, but I would just like you to comment on the mystery. It seems a mystery to me, is that once you do this work and through whatever agencies that you get rid of these defilements and these toxins and these cravings and these negative aspects that we've been able to create so well as human beings, that instead of just existential emptiness and voidness and nothingness and bye-bye, compassion arises, greater compassion, and your ability to transmit and do good in the service of others, other beings, increases. So what does that say about the deepest nature of reality? I find it awesome and deeply, deeply hope-giving and inspiring. So what is that mystery, and how do you account for that?
Dear friends, stay tuned to part two of this conversation with Joseph Goldstein. Thank you very much for being a part of this conversation. We hope that you were moved as we are moved being part of it ourselves. We'd also like to say that this is being funded by Roger and myself. It comes out of our pockets. So if you would like to help us to mainly to get this podcast out to more people, because the bigger audience have, which is steadily growing, but the more people we can reach and the more marketing we can do, the more positive effect we can have on the world. So we've done a couple of ways, but we'd like you to buy us a cup of coffee. Very simple. And I do that with podcasts that I support, and I find it very satisfying. So thank you for your help. Thank you for your presence, and thank you for all you are and all you do. We love you.